Info on Facebook at Itasca Empty Bowls Project. Slight chance of showers tonight, mostly cloudy, lows in the 40s, and showers likely tomorrow with highs 57 to 65.
Hello, I'm Dave Seglins.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens,
Compass points south. Stellantis says it will be investing billions in the U.S. and pulling some production from Canada. That leaves Brampton, Ontario in the lurch. And the mayor says the federal government needs to get busy working out a trade agreement with the Trump administration.
And he smelled a non-rat. It's affectionately known as the Chicago rat hole, or splatatui, depending on your preference. But a scientist has now shown that the indentation in the cement of a Chicago sidewalk may be rat-shaped, but was not a rat's doing.
Those stories and more coming up on the Wednesday edition of As It Happens.
There is more ahead from As It Happens in a few moments here on People Powered KAXC. Support comes from the Northland Foundation, working within Northeast Minnesota, offering grants, small business supports, and programs to help people and communities, working toward a future where everyone feels they belong and can thrive. More at northlandfdn.org. Let's take a listen to our album of the week. It is by Robert Finley. It's called Hallelujah, Don't Let the Devil Fool Ya. Leaning heavily on Robert Finley's gospel roots, this one's called I Wanna Thank You.
Thank you.
I'm Dave Seglin, sitting in for Neil Cooksall.
Good evening. I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight,
spinning their wheels, a major automaker abruptly announces it's moving production from Brampton, Ontario to Illinois. The mayor of Brampton says it's just more proof that Ottawa has to get tough in U.S. trade negotiations.
Unfree and unclear. Israel has released hundreds of detainees, but a Palestinian pediatrician arrested in Gaza 9 months ago is still in Israeli custody. An advocate for Dr. Hassam Abu Safia tells us he's far from alone.
Beyond a reasonable drought, months of dry weather are forcing a Nova Scotia farmer to make some tough decisions. She's not sure how much longer she can keep up the struggle to keep some of her animals.
The whole truth and nothing but. We were all deeply impressed by the rat-shaped impression in a Chicago sidewalk, but now a researcher who dug into the Chicago rat hole tells us he's confident a different rodent made the indent.
Out of thin air, a Saskatchewan woman was shocked when something smashed into her windshield out of a clear blue sky. But she was way past shocked when she realized it was a fish.
And henceforth, German police, and soon you, are confused to discover that someone turned a train compartment into a chicken coop, complete with straw, and left three chickens on board. As it happens, the Wednesday edition, radio that brings you the inside coop. Thousands of Brampton auto workers had pinned their hopes on the Jeep Compass because their plant was where the automaker Stellantis planned to make the Compass. But that was before Donald Trump became president again. Today, Stellantis announced it's moving production south as part of an $18 billion investment in the United States. The federal government says the move is a direct response to President Trump's punishing tariffs on the auto industry. Here's what Ontario Premier Doug Ford had to say about the move.
I don't understand. They're investing $13 billion in the U.S. We're, you know, an auto manufacturing powerhouse here. We're competitive. We can produce the best vehicles anywhere in the entire world, right here in Ontario. So I'm going to keep pushing like they've never seen before. I want to keep the Brampton plant open no matter what. But again, until we see a deal made between Canada and the U.S., the CUSMA deal, how do you figure any company can figure it out? It's the uncertainty that President Trump has not just brought to Canada, he's brought it to the entire world. And protectionism does not work. Their economy is slowing and there's more unemployment. So do you know how you fix that? Make a deal with Canada.
Ontario Premier Doug Ford talking about today's announcement that the automaker Stellantis will be manufacturing the Jeep Compass at a plant in Illinois rather than Brampton, Ontario. Patrick Brown is the mayor of Brampton. That's where we reached him earlier today.
Mayor Brown, how much of a hit is Brampton set to take with this move by Stellantis?
Well, this is a punch to the gut, and it's not just the 3,000 hardworking Stellantis Unifor local 1285 employees. It's the associated auto parts jobs we have in our community, which are significant. It's the hospitality jobs, the restaurants around the assembly plant, the logistics sector that supports the plant. This stings. This hurts. And, you know, there's no way you can put lipstick on the pig. This is ugly news for our city and our country.
And what was your initial reaction when you first heard this?
Well, in many respects, this has been telegrammed to us. You know, Donald Trump has said since he got elected that he was going after Canadian auto jobs, that he was putting tariffs on. So when I heard the news from Stellantis last night, you know, it's frankly what I think is the very real-life consequences of these tariffs. They're going to cost Canadian jobs. They're going to hurt communities. He is going after not just auto jobs, the steel sector, aluminum. He's going after Canadian jobs, and he's been able to do so with very little pushback thus far.
And yet in 2023, Stellantis' chief operating officer reassured you and workers in Brampton that it was committed to the plant and that it would reopen. Do you feel a sense of betrayal?
I do, for a number of reasons. You know, when there was the global economic slowdown in 2009, it was the Canadian government that bailed them out. In 2022, it was Prime Minister Trudeau and Premier Ford at an announcement in Windsor promising hundreds of millions for the retooling of these two plants and billions in incentives for production. And, they've reneged on that agreement. And so I'm angry at the Trump administration. I'm livid with Stellantis for bailing on their obligations to Canadian taxpayers. And I really think it's time that we stop taking this line down.
You say you're livid. Reading the newspapers in Ohio and Michigan, they're rejoicing and they're saying, look, this is the reshoring of U.S. auto jobs. What is a community like Brampton to do in a scenario like this?
Well, my concern is that if Trump is able to be successful in stealing these jobs from Canada, then it's going to be replicated in every community. You know, he's not going to be happy with just stealing one plant from Brampton. He's going after the entire sector, and he's been outspoken to that effect. And so my worry is that it's going to be very difficult days ahead for Canada if we don't push back, if we don't use every tool at our disposal to stand up for these sectors that Donald Trump is targeting.
We're hearing this from you. We're hearing this from Ontario's Premier Ford, pushing back, saying it's time to push back against the Trump tariffs. But can you really hope to change the minds of these major automakers?
Mm-hmm. Well, I had conversations with them last night, and they said as long as tariffs are in place, this is our business reality. This is in response to the tariffs. Which means we need to deal with these tariffs. And a year ago, we had retaliatory tariffs in place that were put aside in the hopes that we could get a deal. Well, we don't have a deal. And so everything from the oil and gas sector to electricity to commodities to rare minerals, the assets that Canada has that the U.S. depends on, we need to make sure there's tariffs on those essential goods for Americans. I don't want to be in a trade war with the U.S., but I especially don't want to be in a trade war where it's one-sided, where there's tariffs on Canadians and nothing in response. And of course, Trump's going to continue with this if he thinks that there's no consequence for the U.S. economy.
And so are you suggesting an escalation that our prime minister in Canada needs to hit back against the U.S.?
Well, beyond an escalation, a response. There hasn't been any escalation. We dropped the retaliatory tariffs. And so at the very least, there needs to be a response. And go further, if he's not responding, then we need to escalate. But we haven't even had a response since we dropped the retaliatory tariffs. And so I'm just tired of us being essentially this laissez-faire approach where we just accept this. My community is tired, we're hurt, we're angry that we've had this laissez-faire approach. A plant that's been in our community for as long as we can remember is leaving, and that production is going to be in Illinois, and that hurts.
Well, today Stellantis did say that, quote, we have plans for Brampton and we will share them upon further discussions with the Canadian government. Does that give you any ray of hope here?
No, in the sense that I was on the phone with them last night and they said, if tariffs are lifted, if there's a trade agreement, we know there's work we can do at this plant. Well, that means very little to me right now, and it means very little to the workers who have lost their jobs due to the fact that there is no sign of the auto tariffs being lifted. There's no sign of an agreement right now. If anything, the fact that companies like Stellantis are heeding Trump's a call is going to motivate him to do more of it. We're going the opposite direction that we need to go right now.
Thousands of auto workers were hoping to get back to work. Now that's down the drain. What do you say to a worker who has just heard this news in Brampton?
That I'm devastated for them, that I worry about their families, and we're going to do whatever we can in Brampton to fight for them, to advocate for them, that we want to save these jobs. We want auto jobs to be available in this plant. But if we're not able to salvage this industry, we're going to do whatever we can to find other opportunities for these workers and their families.
Mayor Brown, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Patrick Brown is the mayor of Brampton, Ontario. That's where we reached him. Late this afternoon, news broke that the Canadian government had threatened legal action against Stellantis. In a letter to the automaker, Industry Minister Melanie Joly said the company had accepted financial support from the government on the condition that it kept production in Canada. In June, drought conditions forced Crystal Joyce Manning to start hauling water to her farm. Months later, she's still dealing with the impacts, and she's hardly alone. In parts of the Maritimes, farmers have been dealing with catastrophic drought. The latest data from the Canadian Drought Monitor categorizes conditions as exceptional in some areas. An analysis shows several towns in Nova Scotia have seen their driest three-month periods on record. Ms. Manning co-owns Evangeline Trail Rides, a horse riding business, and also raises beef cattle. We reached her today in Colebrook, Nova Scotia.
Crystal, when this dry weather began in June, did you have any idea you'd still be dealing with the effects now?
No, we really thought, oh, well, you know, everything's going to get better. We make it through this week, we'll be okay. But it has been a long summer.
So you had to begin hauling water to your farm months ago. What happened to your water supply that forced you to do that?
So we rely on some rivers and streams to water our livestock in the summer when they're out to pasture. And they have all dried up. So it meant hauling water from our farm and our house wells. We dried up to the house wells, and then we went to another pond and started pumping from there, which involves, you know, we had to buy pumps, we had to buy stock tanks, we had to buy holding tanks to transport water. So it's taken about 3.5 to 4 hours a day to haul water.
And has that remained the case since June?
Yes.
And what's that been like for you, having to bring all that water that you need for your animals?
It's a time consuming. It's, you know, it takes a lot of time to do that, which takes you away from other farming responsibilities. And it's, you know, it's wear and tear on vehicles. It was an expense to buy those tanks, to buy the pumps, the things like that kind of thing.
And it's not just water directly for the animals. The lack of rains also affected your land and the grazing land. How are you feeding your livestock now?
So we're into our winter's feed. Usually we hope to get a second or sometimes a third cut on hay leach. We usually can leave livestock out to pasture till about hunting season, which here in Nova Scotia, it's the end of October. But we brought cattle home probably about the end of September, 1st of October, which is two months earlier than what we're used to, kind of thing.
And you say you're into your winter feed. What does that portend for your supplies?
So we figure we were about 400 round bales short to feed our, we have about 100 head of beef cattle and about 40 horses. But we did find a feed supplier that we were able to buy some corn silage, which that meant, you know, preparing land to change our feeding program into feeding corn silage instead of feeding haylage. So that was, you know, an expense and time-consuming kind of thing, but we're pretty sure we have enough feed for the winter. We will call some horses this fall. We will call some cattle this fall when we preg check in the fall. So yeah, we're hoping we're good, but we're going to need that water source, and we don't know when that's going to come.
When you say having to call them, what are you talking in terms of?
So in the fall, we preg check our cows, and anything that is in calf, we will keep. Anything that is open, we will be shipping them.
Does that mean selling off some of these animals?
Yes, because there's no sense feeding something. It's got to be done. They have to produce to be fed, kind of thing. They have a job to do. It's their job. They need to produce that calf that we can sell in the following fall. But if there's nothing there to eat to feed them, there's no sense keeping them, kind of thing.
And how hard a decision is that for you?
It's a tough decision. A lot of these cattle have been my daughter or my son's 4-H projects. You've bred and raised them from the calf, kind of thing. So
I understand drought isn't the only challenge you've faced. You've also had the impact of fires and other things. Tell us a little bit about that in terms of what you've been dealing with all summer.
So with the drought, there was a large forest fire in Annapolis, which our brother-in-law actually had to have some cattle evacuated from that. That was kind of spooky when the cops were closing the roads behind us and we were hauling cattle out of the fire areas. Also, we run a trail riding business with horses, and I think it was 7-8 weeks that the woods were closed, so we were unable to have an income during that time because we were unable to ride in the woods.
And how long was that?
7 weeks.
7 weeks. And what's that like for your business?
That's a big impact. You know, the summer is our best time for rides. We do ride all year long. The summer is our biggest income. But it worked out. You know, I have a sister that lives in Maitland, so we actually shipped some horses up there, but we were just hoping that we didn't run her well dry. But so the horses had a little bit of a break, and it was a little bit of it was less water for us to haul with them not being there. But they're all home now, and we're full rides, and we're just hoping for some rain.
We've been hearing that call and that hope across the Maritimes. Have you... How does the farming community come together at a time like this?
You know, we get together. We were at our 4-H provincial show here a couple weeks ago, and, you know, no one wanted to talk about it. You know, you watch the kids try to buff their animals, and we're like, oh, God, they're wasting water. Everybody is in the same boat or, you know, on the same ranch kind of thing. You know, everybody's cringing, you know, hey, if you got enough hay, what are you going to do? Are you going to sell off? Are you going to hold your cattle? It's everybody's in the same boat. Like, it's not like, you know, part of, you know, it's not Cumberland County doesn't have rain and we do, or Annapolis doesn't have rain and we do. Nobody has it. Like, the whole province is, you know, it's a stress. It's a lot of farm stress.
So what do you think is in store for you through the winter and into next year?
Just got to wait and see. They are calling for some rain maybe tonight, but it definitely doesn't look that way.
I don't know if you believe in this, but what does the Farmer's Almanac say?
I have never, ever read the Farmer's Almanac. And it's every year I think, oh, maybe that'd be a great Christmas stocking gift, and I never seem to pick one up.
Well, we hope for rain soon. Thank you very much for telling us about your situation right now.
Okay, thank you, Dave.
Bye, Crystal.
You have a great day.
Crystal Joyce Manning co-owns Evangeline Trail Rides in Stanley, Nova Scotia. We reached her today about an hour away in Colebrook. It's known internationally as the Chicago rat hole. Ever since an animal, widely believed to be the titular rat, made a rat-shaped impression in a patch of wet Chicago concrete, it has made an impression on visitors from around the world who've traveled to see it. It has since been removed, but last year, the Chamber of Commerce for the neighborhood where the rodent-shaped divot was located held a naming contest for the attraction and landed on Splatatouille. That, of course, is a reference to the film Ratatouille, our second one this week for anyone counting. But unfortunately, it is factually incorrect, because according to a new study published today in Biology Letters, the rat hole is, in fact, not one. Michael Granatoski is the lead author of the paper. We reached him in New York City.
Michael, if this isn't a rat hole, what is it?
Well, from our analyses, we determined it's a squirrel.
Ta-da! The squirrel.
Perfect.
This is obviously much fun. This isn't hardcore research, but you still applied scientific method to this. What exactly did your team do?
So what we did is we took advantage of the fact that people from the public took images of the actual Chicago rat hole with things like quarters, dimes, pennies in there and used that for scale. From there, we were actually able to get measurements, anatomical features from the imprint itself, and then compare those to species that it could possibly be, right? So there are many mammal species in the Chicago area. Some we could immediately get rid of, you know. It certainly wasn't a deer. But we narrowed it down to, you know, 8 probable rodent species. And then from our analyses, ran statistics to determine the most likely candidate for what made the imprint.
So how sure are you it's a squirrel?
We are, I think, 98%+ sure it's a squirrel. Now, I say this because there are two different species of squirrel in the Chicago area. There's the fox squirrel, and then there's the eastern gray squirrel. Both are, you know, pretty similar in basic shape. You know, one species is a little larger than the other. And so our analyses actually came out 50-50 for each species. So while it is a squirrel, we couldn't get it down to the exact species.
Now, you are recasting, if I can use that word, a mythologized Chicago institution. Are you concerned that any passionate fans of the rat hole are going to be upset with your findings that it's a squirrel?
I hope not. Hopefully what we demonstrate with this is, you know, this feature, this rat hole, has come up in the media multiple times, and we brought it back to life again, right? So if anything, we're keeping the legend alive, keeping people talking about it, and getting people excited about the natural world around them, right? Every time you look at this imprint, it's a reminder that in a city, humans are not isolated. There are many other species that have made it its home, and this is just a permanent record of that.
Now, your online biography describes you as a fairly serious academic evolutionary biomechanist whose research investigates animal locomotion. How in the world did you end up studying the Chicago rat hole?
I think, like so many other people, right, I saw it and I was curious about what it was, right? And so while the subject area of trying to figure out what imprints of sidewalk is not part of my research at all, the methodology that we use are things we use in the lab all the time when we try to understand how different features evolved or how different animals might have moved. So it's the same methodology, just a different fun kind of question to demonstrate that science, you know, can be anything, right? As long as we have a question that we want to answer, we can apply that scientific method.
So believe it or not, this is not the first interview on our show that we've done about this particular rat hole, squirrel hole. We've actually spoken twice with the Chicago comedian and artist Winslow Demain, who first helped make that whole image go viral. I'd like to play a short clip from our first conversation with him for you and our listeners.
The tweet that I wrote said, had to make a pilgrimage to the Chicago rat hole. And I think that it was just the fact that I used the word pilgrimage that led so many people to visit it. And so I just put up a picture of it, and, you know, it was just there full of, you know, rainwater when I found it. And other users across the internet and indeed across America have, like, driven there to, like, visit it and, like, leave tokens behind. So I've seen lots of pictures with incense and candles and lighters and lots and lots of change, and there's even like a little tombstone that they've left for it.
Of course. Yeah.
And
well, we don't know what happened to this squirrel.
We don't know what happened.
We'll never know.
Yeah.
So, Michael, has your research given you any insight into what might have happened to the animal that created this?
Well, while we don't have direct evidence, right? When we look at the actual imprint themselves, we can't see any evidence of anything walking up towards the imprint or anything walking away. And further, it had to be, squirrels are pretty light, right? So for it to make an indent that deep probably meant it had to be there for a while. So I don't think it walked away gingerly after a fall, to put it as lightly as possible.
So you're not even suggesting this was a squirrel. You're saying this is a dead squirrel.
I think, yeah, dead squirrel or close to dead squirrel.
Of one or two different species varieties.
Exactly, yep.
At the end of the day, quite a lot of work for this analysis. What are you hoping the scientific community and the public takes away from this?
So first, for the public, I hope that it promotes curiosity, right? I mean, if everyone had questions about what this is, how it got there, and that's exactly using the scientific method appropriately. For the broader scientific community, I hope, one, it actually helps have some implications for understanding trace fossils, and then two, the importance of science outreach and science communication.
Michael, thanks for helping us understand the trace sidewalk squirrel sightings of Chicago.
Hey, thank you so much. It was a true pleasure.
Michael Granatoski is a professor in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. We reached him today in New York City. I regret to inform you it's time for another chilling episode of our regular feature, Chicken Trouble. Chicken Trouble. Chicken Trouble. Chicken Trouble. To the oblivious passengers on the German train from Essen to Cologne last night, everything seemed normal. But little did they know that three things weren't normal. And those three things were strutting around blank-eyed and pecking at the floor mere meters from their seats. When the train pulled into Cologne station, staff stumbled upon a mystery. It was the last straw. It was also the first straw. It was the only straw, since there's usually no straw on a passenger train at all. But in one compartment, there was a lot of straw, such as you might see on the floor of a chicken coop. That was not a coincidence, because the compartment was a chicken coop. If you define chicken coop as a place with three or more chickens in it, because you see there were three chickens in it. As people who work on a train, they were immediately struck by one question. Why are there chickens on here? They quickly surmised that the chickens had not acted alone and did not know they were on a train, or what a train was, or anything. And if they find the culprit, police plan to charge them with whatever charge applies to scattering straw around a train compartment and putting chickens there and then leaving. The train required extra sanitizing, the chickens were safely delivered to animal services, and the staff that discovered them had undoubtedly been trained to deal with bird emergencies, but there's nothing like hands-on experience. Here's Allie with Coop.
Pull up on myself, oh yeah. I could feel the cracks start forming. Been missing the wild, oh wow. Think I need a lucid omen. Stack up and reload. Here we go again.
Allie with Coop. We're going to take a short break now. When we return, we remember Raila Odinga, one of Kenya's most influential political figures, who garnered wide support as he pushed to change the country's one-party system. And a Saskatchewan woman explains how she ended up in a motor vehicle accident with a fish. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Dave Seglins.
Thank you for listening to As It Happens on People Powered KAXE. Good evening, I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 7 o'clock, DJ Dang, your host for On the River, bringing you a fabulous mix of music. And 10 o'clock, more great music on Headwaters with Kari Headland. Support comes from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. We have a chance of showers and thunderstorms this evening, mostly cloudy, lows in the 40s, and tomorrow, showers, likely possible thunderstorms, highs anywhere from 57 to 65, southeast winds 10 to 15. Lows tomorrow night in the 50s, chance of rain, slight chance of showers on Friday, highs in the 60s. Support comes from Sanford Health with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org.
Earlier this week, Palestinians and Israelis alike rejoiced at the release of their loved ones. 20 living Israeli hostages returned home, and some 1,900 Palestinians, including 1,700 Gazans who had been detained without charge, were released from Israeli prisons. But thousands of Palestinians are still in detention, and Physicians for Human Rights Israel says dozens of them are healthcare workers. Dr. Hassam Abu Safia is among them. The director of Gaza's Kamal Adwan Hospital was first detained in December. He had remained at the hospital even after his 15-year-old son was killed in an Israeli drone strike. An image of him wearing a white lab coat and walking toward Israeli tanks moments before his detention subsequently went viral. Now, human rights organizations around the world have renewed their calls for his release. Naji Abbas is the director of the Prisoners and Detainees Department at Physicians for Human Rights Israel, or PHRI. We reached him in Ramallah. Naji, what is the latest information you have about Dr. Abu Safia and the condition he's in?
The last updated information that we have about Dr. Abu Safia is from 3 weeks ago, when our lawyer, the lawyer of PHRI, visited him in Ofer prison. Dr. Abu Safia described during the visit horrific conditions. He said that he's getting a very little amount of food every day. He said that he was suffering from scabies for weeks and he couldn't meet a doctor. He described violence that he's facing, he and the other detainees, every week. He was so confused because he didn't, till now, after 9 months, he didn't know why he's still in detention.
And he is not facing a charge?
Nothing. Dr. Abu Safia and another, till now, in this moment, Dr. Abu Safia and another 17 doctors from Gaza who are still in detention, in the Israeli detention, none of them are not facing any official charges.
Now, I know you spoke with his son earlier today. How is his family doing?
The family is so confused, so frustrating. His son, his older son, Elias, 2 days ago, he waited till the evening with the hope that his father will get released. He stayed in the point where the detainees were released in Gaza. He waited to the evening hours, hoping that even that his father is not in the list, that he will be released, because different media releases spoke that another deal, that Dr. Abu Safia will be included. But unfortunately, that didn't happen. The family is so frustrating. They are so confused. They are asking every day. They are reaching out to us asking why he's still in detention. And unfortunately, even us, we don't have the answer, because legally there is no reason why he's in detention.
As you know, the IDF claims that Dr. Abu Safia is suspected of cooperating or working with Hamas. I know his hospital and many human rights organizations have denied that. He's not been charged. What is your sense of why he and many dozens of Palestinian health workers are still being held?
First of all, the key word when we describe the words of the Israeli state or the Israeli army, the key word is claiming. They are claiming. They are claiming for 9 months. They are claiming for 2 years now. On the ground, on their court, in the Israeli court, he's not being charged. That's a fact. It's not a claim. We published a report a few months ago in February this year, with 20 testimonies of doctors, nurses, and paramedics who were arrested and kept in detention. Our conclusion is that a main reason of these arrests, mass arrests of medical staff, one of the main reasons is that this policy is part of destroying the health system. When you arrest staff of a surgery department in one hospital, that means that there is no surgeons to treat the patient, to treat the injured people. So keeping Dr. Abu Safia and the other doctors in detention till now was part of a policy of destroying the health system in Gaza. Today, if you ask me about the reason why Dr. Abu Safia is not released and the other doctors, we believe that the Israeli authorities and the Israeli army are afraid of the sound, of the voice of these doctors. They know that the international media and the international community is waiting to hear what these people, what these doctors have faced in the last months and the last year and a half. They are waiting to hear their testimonies. And the Israeli authorities are afraid of that now.
There is to be another hearing tomorrow in Dr. Abu Safia's case. He's had no legal representation at the last of these hearings. Are you at all optimistic this one might actually end in his release?
I can say I hope. And to be honest, we don't have much expectation of these hearings. We hope that he will get released, but we don't have much expectation. We hope that the international pressure, that the media pressure, will force the Israeli authorities to release him. From the legal procedures, when we are speaking, we are describing a procedure that there is no lawyer to represent him. We are speaking about the procedure. Some doctors said that the hearings that they had lasted for 1 minute. 1 minute by a camera phone. They are not bringing the detainee to the court. So we don't have much expectation of these Israeli legal procedures. But we hope that the pressure, the diplomatic pressure, the media pressure will force the Israeli authorities to release these doctors.
Do you have any indication as to whether Dr. Abu Safia and others detained alongside him, whether they even are aware that there's a ceasefire?
Actually, not. Actually, no. Palestinian detainees in the last 2 years are disconnected from the outside world. They don't know anything. Their families are not allowed to visit them or to speak to them. The Red Cross, the ICRC, can't visit and don't have any access. And that's a very obvious violation of the international humanitarian law. The ICRC had access to Abu Ghraib, to Guantanamo, but to the Israeli detention facility, they don't have access for 2 years now. They are totally disconnected from the outside world. So we think Dr. Abu Safia, maybe he know about the deal because some detainees where he's being held were released 2 days ago. But we are sure that he don't know the details about the end of the war or the deal and the exchange.
Well, we will be watching as the world is. Naji, we'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you.
Naji Abbas is the director of the Prisoners and Detainees Department at Physicians for Human Rights Israel. We reached him in Ramallah. Israel maintains that it adheres to international legal standards with regards to the treatment of Palestinians held in its prisons. His outsized influence in Kenya was apparent today, as thousands of people all over the country took to the streets to mourn his death together. Raila Odinga, a longtime opposition politician and former Kenyan prime minister, died today. He was 80 years old. His ambition to reshape Kenya spanned most of his life. He was part of one of the country's most important political families. He ran for the presidency 5 times, unsuccessfully, most recently in 2022. He repeatedly insisted that electoral corruption had prevented his victory. But even though he never held office, Raila Odinga held power. He was able to mobilize enormous crowds for anti-government demonstrations, which sometimes turned violent, which led to his imprisonment on multiple occasions. Nevertheless, the way Kenya's government operates today is thanks in part to Raila Odinga, who's considered one of the founding figures responsible for the country's multi-party democracy. In 1991, Mr. Odinga was a guest on this program after nationwide pro-democracy protests against the country's one-party dictatorship. Former host Michael Enright asked him what was moving people to push for change.
Well, you know, the prevailing political acrimony, if you like, and this illegal oppression in Kenya that's going on has its roots in the flagrant violation of the fundamental human and democratic rights of the people of Kenya by the Moi regime. This thing dates back to 1982, when the Moi regime decided to legislate against formation of any other political party, making Kenya a de jure one-party dictatorship. Efforts to have this amendment repealed to allow the formation of other political parties have been strenuously resisted by the government.
Well, it's interesting that this demonstration indicates a change of mind, a change of heart, rather, in the minds of many people, because they have been afraid to demonstrate publicly in the past.
Yes.
What has changed? Why are they now willing to go out and do it publicly?
Well, I think that generally the whole geopolitics in Africa has changed. Because there are people, of course, that do not live in a vacuum. They have also been seeing what has been happening in other countries, like in Zambia, for example, where public pressure has forced the regime there to yield to political changes. So that, I think, has got something to do with this. Apart from this, the economic situation in Kenya has worsened over the last 1 year. And then there's also a lot of revelations that have come to light about high-level corruption within the political system. So I would say that it's a combination of a lot of other factors, both internal and external, that is responsible for this change.
Kenyan opposition politician Raila Odinga, who later became Kenya's prime minister, talking to Michael Enright in 1991. Raila Odinga died today. He was 80 years old. Recently, Marie Ahlstrom had to make a strange call to her insurance company, a call in which she had to describe how she'd been driving to her home in Turtle Lake, Saskatchewan, when she hit something, or rather something hit her, something that her insurance company wasn't sure qualified as a claim. We reached Marie Ahlstrom in Turtle Lake. Marie, let's start at the very beginning. You're driving along and something hits your car. What's going through your mind at that point?
Something hit my windshield, and it was a big, loud bang. And, at first I was frightened because I didn't know what had hit. I thought perhaps it was a rock, but there was nobody around. And so I put on my four-way flashers, pulled over to the side of the road, and calmed myself down a bit.
Were you going very fast at the time?
Well, along that road, it's only 80 kilometers.
All right. So you put on the hazards, pull over.
Yep. And got myself together, basically, because I was pretty shaky. And the windshield just instantly smashed. And there was lines going every which direction. And so I couldn't see. I couldn't see to drive because the windshield was so smashed up.
And what did you think it was?
At first, I thought it was a rock. And then I thought, I don't think it was a rock because I could see blood.
Blood?
Yeah, I could see some blood. And so I thought, well, it can't be a rock.
So what clued you into what it actually was?
I didn't clue in until I drove home about 20 kilometers an hour, but I only had a couple miles to go. And then my husband was outside and the two of us checked the windshield out, and you could see the actual imprint of the fish scales in the windshield.
Fish scales?
And then, of course, fish scale. You could see the imprint of the fish scales. And then there was fish scales, blood, and guts all over the windshield. Yeah.
Oh,
so
my.
We knew for sure it was a fish.
And what did you think?
It was like, well, you know, because we live right at the lake, there has been times when fish, birds have dropped fish. And so that's not unusual for that to have happened. We had a good friend that just lived down the way from us, and he could smell fish around his yard. And when he checked up on his roof, there was a fish laying in his eaves troughing. So I think what happens is the osprey catch the fish, but they're too heavy for them, and they drop them.
So you think your car accident was a falling fish from an eagle or an osprey?
That's right. Yep. That's had to be. There was nobody else around, so had to have been that.
Any other reports of fish hitting cars, or do you hold that distinct honor?
You know what? I don't think I do, because once this aired, there was a lady that lives out of town from us, and she said that she was driving close to our resort here, and a fish slid down her windshield as well. So I don't know when it happened to her. I don't know if it was lately, or I don't know when it happened to her, but she told me that story when she heard about my story.
Any idea what type of fish it was?
Well, it was probably a jackfish, but I don't know if it was a jack or a pickerel.
Huh. Now, I understand you had to call your insurance company and explain what had happened, and they weren't so sure that your fish qualified as wildlife. Tell us that story.
Yeah, so I had to call on Monday morning, because this happened on a Friday, of course, after everything was closed. So I called Monday morning and spoke to the fellow and told him what had happened. And he said that it wasn't covered under the wildlife. And so he said that fish doesn't qualify.
He might have been confused at first.
I don't know. What he said, people don't hit fish. They hit deer and they hit bear and whatever, but they don't hit fish. And so he said it wasn't qualified. And so my husband then the next day went into our local Turtleford agencies, and the girls there called and spoke to a supervisor, and he said, yes, most definitely it was covered. And so they did call me back and say, Saskatchewan Insurance called me back and said, yes, for sure it was covered. So that was good. I didn't have to pay for a new windshield from a flying fish.
So how's your windshield now?
It's fine right now. It was, we got a new one installed, and it's very nice. So, yeah, so far so good.
Any words of warning to others driving in the Turtle Lake area?
Just beware of falling fish. It's just so unusual for this to happen. It's just very much a big surprise to me.
Well, thanks for telling us about it, Marie.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Bye now.
Bye for now.
Marie Ahlstrom's car was hit by a falling fish. We reached her in Turtle Lake, Saskatchewan. Every year, tens of thousands of people enter the Wildlife Photographer of the Year competition in the hopes of being named the best of the best at documenting the majesty of nature. And this year, 10-year-old Jamie Smart made the list. Jamie won the top spot in the 10 years and under category for her photograph, The Weaver's Lair. It's a stunning shot of an orb weaver spider nestled in its silken retreat, which is beaded with dew on a chilly September morning in Wales. Jamie told the BBC's Lucy Hawkings what it feels like to have her picture named among the best in the world.
It's just amazing. I can't believe it. I'm over the moon. So I've been doing a lot of macro photography over the last year. And with macro photography, you don't need to rely on the natural light around you because you're using a flash and diffuser. So I always check to make sure that it's going to be a really good morning to go out and look for bugs. It's really cold overnight as well when I was looking for the bugs. So everything was covered in water droplets. I spotted on the top of a dead dock leaf a little funnel that was covered in water droplets too. But I didn't even see the spider at first. I just saw this funnel. So I looked closer. And there's this teeny tiny little spider in the middle, and I thought it'd make a really cute picture. But I had a bit of trouble with it because I had to keep changing my angles and my settings to be able to get the light to penetrate into the funnel. Even though it's not that big, it was having a bit of a problem.
And Jamie, you're obviously not scared of spiders.
No, I love spiders and all bugs, even the reptiles. I just love all animals. And at the moment, spiders are one of my favourites.
And where does your love of photography come from, Jamie? How long have you been taking photos for?
So it all started with a massive passion for dinosaurs when I was 8 years old. But when I found out that I wasn't able to see a real dinosaur, I found that birds and animals were all related to dinosaurs. So my passion for wildlife began there. I was using binoculars, but I found it really hard then focusing on wildlife before the mammal ran away or the bird flew off. So Dad asked if I'd like to use a camera, but I didn't want to drop the camera because I knew how expensive it was. But when I started getting pictures of sparrows in the bushes and things around the garden, I improved in my photography, and that's where it all started.
Jamie Smart's photograph, The Weaver's Lair, is the winner of the 10 years and under category for the Wildlife Photographer of the Year competition. She's 10. She was speaking to the BBC's Lucy Hawkings. You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio. You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening. And I'm Dave Seglins. Take care.
Ooh.